On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Conservative legal hotshot Jack Goldsmith was tapped for a key job in the Bush Justice Department, in part because of his get-tough reputation on terror. But within hours of getting inside as head of the Office of Legal Counsel, the office that sets legal boundaries for the presidency, this conservative top gun was shocked by what he saw. The law being tortured, he says, to expand the power of the presidency. Now he's out and telling all about what we should learn from the wartime powers of Lincoln and FDR and Bush. Up next on Point, Jack Goldsmith and the terror presidency. Joining me now in the studio is Jack Goldsmith. He's a professor of law at Harvard Law School. As assistant attorney general from 2003 to 2004, 9+ months, he headed the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department. That's the office that interprets legal boundaries for the presidency. He was advisor to the general counsel of the Defense Department from 2002 to 2003. His new book is The Terror Presidency, Law and Judgment Inside the Bush Administration. Jack Goldsmith, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Right in the front of your book, you quote the former Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, who served as Attorney General under FDR. And let me just read it, because it sets the stage quite perfectly, as one would expect, for what you're writing. That comprehensive and undefined presidential powers hold both practical advantages and grave dangers for the country will impress anyone who has served as legal advisor to a president in time of transition and public anxiety. I guess that pretty much describes the moment at which you came on the scene.
It certainly describes my attitude when I left the scene, yes.
2003, the fall, you are tapped to be head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department. Describe what that office does and the moment at which it, then you, found itself.
The Office of Legal Counsel is an office of about 22 lawyers inside the Justice Department. And basically, the executive branch has tens of thousands of lawyers who every day try to ensure that the president and all executive branch officials comply with the law, because a lot of executive branch activity is not subject to judicial review. It never goes to court. And that's the Office of Legal Counsel's job. And as is relevant to this book, it was my job, subject to review by the Attorney General and the President, to interpret the legal constraints on the President's power in the war on terrorism.
Why did they pick you?
I believe they picked me because they thought correctly that I shared their basic attitudes and outlooks toward the law and towards the war on terrorism.
Meaning?
Meaning that I was generally in favor, based on what I knew at the time when I was interviewed for the job, I was generally in favor of the supportive of the way the president had fought the war on terrorism. I was generally in favor of their legal arguments in favor of the policies they had embraced. I had written law review articles and opinion op-eds supportive of what they've been doing.
But you had been in that office just a matter of hours, as I read your book, The Terror Presidency, when your breath began to be taken away a bit. What did you find when the doors opened and you were inside?
It wasn't exactly the first few hours. It was the first few weeks that I began to have concerns. I came to read some of the opinions that my predecessors in the Office of Legal Counsel had written in connection with various war on terrorism policies, in particular in connection with surveillance issues and in connection with interrogation. And I, after absorbing the opinions, came to the conclusion that they had some very serious errors.
Errors along what line?
Several lines. Some errors, in my opinion, of sort of interpreting statutes, how to interpret statutes, whether they had read the statutes that constrained or enhanced the president's power in the proper way. I had concerns in some of the opinions about the what I viewed as the extraordinarily broad conception of presidential power that the opinions embraced. And then in some of the opinions, it was really the concern was not just the breadth of the constitutional arguments, but the breadth of the analysis. The analysis seemed, particularly in the opinions related to interrogation, to go much, much further than was necessary to support the actual activities that were going on. And I worried about these overly broad opinions and what might be done in their name beyond what I knew was going on.
Paint the picture of the personalities that proved to be key here as you moved into this role. John Yoo was there, David Addington was there, and others. Introduce us.
John Yoo was actually one of my predecessors. By the time I got there, he had left. Mm-hmm. And he was a deputy in the Office of Legal Counsel, a prominent war power scholar at the University of California Law School. And he had been one of the main, main player inside the Office of Legal Counsel in crafting a lot of the counterterrorism policies of the government.
David, a legal scholar, you note in your book, The Terror Presidency, believed that when the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, vested the executive power in the president, it had given him all of the military powers possessed by the King of England, save those expressly given to Congress. So a very big view of presidential power, John, you had.
That particular view is, he's not the first one to hold that view. I mean, in some sense, Alexander Hamilton held that view. But yes, John did, and he would, I'm sure, acknowledge that he held a very expansive view of presidential power, no doubt.
And David Addington?
David Addington at the time was the counsel to the vice president, Richard Cheney. He's now his chief of staff. He was he had an unusually broad and sort of central role in the development of legal policy in the administration, I think an unusual one for the vice president's counsel. And he was always present in the meetings I was at to discuss, always except with one exception, in the meetings I was in to discuss with the White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, and others, various legal issues and legal policy issues in the war on terrorism. And he played a very prominent role in the discussions and arguments.
And by your description, these discussions, arguments, meetings were some kind of meetings. I mean, real Donnybrooks here.
They were very tense because the stakes were so high. Everyone was concerned about putting any limits on the president's power that may lead to people being killed. That was always a concern that was present. People were also trying to comply with the law. That tension between ensuring that the president had the authorities he needed to keep us safe and ensuring that we complied with the law produced some very heated exchanges, yes.
Now, your role in this, or the role of the Office of Legal Counsel, was so crucial because the head of the Office of Legal Counsel would draw lines, and if they stayed within those lines, as broad as they may be, they would be nearly immune from subsequent legal prosecution. And as you describe it, many of them feared that without those interpretations, they would be vulnerable to eventual prosecution.
Yes, let me explain the background before I explain mm-hmm. the role of OLC. This is one of the major themes of the book, and that is at the same time that executive branch officials are trying desperately to do everything possible to keep us safe in the face of horrifying threat reports and enormous uncertainty about when or where or how the terrorists would strike us, and under enormous pressure from all quarters to do everything possible to keep us safe. At the same time they're under those pressures, they found themselves, we found ourselves, bumping up at every turn against a whole array of criminal laws related to surveillance, interrogation, presidential war powers. And yes, everyone in the executive branch was fearful of inadvertently going beyond those lines, not because they weren't trying to violate the law. They certainly weren't. And indeed, they took extraordinary steps to comply with the law. The problem is, in their view, and I share this view, is that a lot of these laws are vague and uncertain. They haven't been applied in this type of war. And yet they would be judged, their heat of battle judgment calls would be judged by later down the road by prosecutors, inspectors generals, independent counsels, foreign prosecutors and the like, who had a different perspective on these things. So they worried all the time about this.
Now, your interpretation of the law, because you represented the Justice Department, which would prosecute, presumably, if this any of these were ever to go to court, was crucial to them, because if you interpreted broadly enough, permissively enough, they had that broad permission.
Yes, the Office of Legal Counsel speaks on behalf of the Justice Department and on behalf of the Attorney General. And when the Department of Justice interprets a law to permit a certain activity, and a government official relies on that interpretation by the Justice Department to engage in that activity, it's obviously very hard for the Justice Department to turn around later and prosecute that person for having violated a law that a previous Justice Department said they weren't violating.
You came into this role, John, you had left behind some pretty big stuff, including the two famous, infamous so-called torture memos that were quite permissive. You eventually overturned those. Describe what happened there.
First of all, let me say that I did disagree with some of John's work, but I think it's unfair to paint him as to paint all or even most of his opinions as being flawed. He did really extraordinary work under a lot of pressure and time constraints inside the government. But yes, I did disagree with some of his opinions, quite a lot, especially some of the opinions related to interrogation. Basically, for the reasons I stated earlier, I found the opinions to be deeply flawed and especially overbroad, and I worried about what would be done in their name and later viewed as attributable to something the Department of Justice said was okay. And so I decided to withdraw them and replace them and to put the techniques that were going on a firmer legal foundation. Doing that was very difficult. There wasn't much precedent for doing so, for withdrawing an opinion of this importance in this context that had been relied on. So I proceeded somewhat cautiously. I wanted to come to a conclusion about the legality of the underlying practices, so that when I withdrew the opinion, I could tell the agency that had been relying on our advice precisely what was and wasn't unlawful. And I had a much easier time doing that with the Department of Defense, because their interrogation techniques were much less were much milder than the what President Bush called the tough interrogation techniques being used by the CIA.
David Addington, in the vice president's camp, very, very tough when you would come in and resist the kind of measures the White House wanted to see sanctioned, I guess we might say. Describe some of those encounters.
Well, perhaps the sharpest encounter came on a matter I'm not at liberty to discuss, and it was in late February or early March of 2003. And another Justice Department lawyer and I went to the White House to let them know that we could not approve of some counterterrorism policies that they wanted to pursue. We couldn't pursue them. We couldn't approve them because we had tried and tried and tried and could not find a legal basis to support them. And he reacted basically by saying, at the contemplation of this, by saying that that I would be responsible when the blood of 100,000 people who died in the next attack, that their blood would be on my hands.
If you rule that way, you quote him saying, yeah, the blood of the 100,000 people who die in the next attack will be on your hands. Wow.
Right.
Well, where were you sitting or standing? or what chair were you standing on when he said that?
I was sitting right next to him. But
in the White House? Or?
It was in the White House counsel's office, yes. And I wouldn't make too much of this for a couple of reasons. One, I mean, in the book, I don't criticize him for saying this. I actually, in fact, use that quotation as an opportunity to explain the tensions that I discussed earlier between fear of attack and fear of law.
Every morning, the president got the threat matrix with all the potential horrendous things that could go wrong.
And reading that matrix and knowing that you are the person responsible for keeping the country safe, and that you are the person and the agency responsible for keeping us safe, really focuses your attention and would give anyone in the president's shoes and the executive branch's shoes enormous pressure to stop the next attack. So I use that quote from David. Again, I spent two or three pages in the book explaining it and using it as an example of the fear, really, that and anxiety that pervaded the executive branch.
We understand that, and yet you were laying yourself, your interpretation, across the tracks in front of this, even in the face of that kind of response.
I was. I mean, I knew what the stakes were even without him saying that, and I wasn't at all pleased about the legal conclusions we had reached, and I had really tried as hard as I knew how to find a way to allow the president to do what he wanted to do, but at some point the arguments just ran out. So I understood the stakes. I wasn't at all happy about them. I assumed what he said was absolutely correct, that in some sense if something went wrong, the pointy-headed lawyers would be responsible for tying the president's hands, just as, if you think about it, one of the main criticisms right after 9/11 was that the lawyers were constraining the policymakers from doing what they needed to do. Remember the FISA wall and all that discussion, which turned out to be, many people thought, a result of cautious lawyering. So I was very sensitive to those concerns, and at some point the legal arguments just ran out.
We'll look further at that perspective. I mean, you are a conservative legal scholar, and still, even for you, at some point, as you say, the arguments ran out. Take us to that, again, famous, infamous bedside scene, Walter Reed Hospital. Attorney General John Ashcroft is there. We've heard, got a taste of this from James Comey and others who have talked about it, but this was the kind of midnight rendezvous where Gonzalez and, well, paint the picture for us of what was at stake. Ashcroft nearly on a deathbed there with his wife and you in the shadows. What did you see?
Well, I was there along with Deputy Attorney General Jim Comey and one of his deputies. And we were there because Attorney General Ashcroft had gone into the hospital the week before, and Jim Comey was the acting Attorney General. And as acting Attorney General, he had relied on and agreed with some advice that I gave him related to a classified program. And he conveyed this advice on behalf of the Justice Department to the White House that did not agree with it. And the White House was basically there in the room to ask the Attorney General to reconsider our decision.
What happened?
We came into the room just a few minutes before Alberto Gonzalez and Andrew Card. They walked in the room. Judge Gonzalez did the talking. He asked how the Attorney General was doing. He made his request. As you say, the Attorney General was in terrible shape. I was just astonished.
Tubes poking out everywhere.
Yeah, but he'd lost a lot of weight. He was ashen. He looked very, very bad. I was very worried about him. I was very worried about what was happening for what it might do to his health. And Judge Gonzalez made his request. Attorney General Ashcroft suddenly and astonishingly came to life. Color came into his face, and he lifted himself up off the hospital bed for a bit. And it was just a two-minute talk, but it was he basically rejected the request. He summarized the Justice Department's concerns, which he shared, and he said he did not appreciate being visited under these circumstances. And then he ended by saying that, in any event, Jim Comey was the acting Attorney General.
So don't come to me for what you want here. His wife was there with you watching this, and you recount an interesting little exchange. Very small, but
And Mrs. Ashcroft was standing behind the Attorney General, and as she was, as you can imagine, extremely worried about her husband, and she was watching the scene. It was a very 5 or 10 minutes, but she was watching the whole thing play out, and she was obviously extremely concerned because her husband was not well. And as Judge Gonzalez and Andrew Card turned to walk out of the door, she basically stuck her tongue out at them. And it was just a sign of sort of extreme disapproval at what had just gone on.
A small gesture, but a loaded one. What were you thinking? I mean, this wasn't the first time that you had seen a really kind of heavy-handed response to any resistance on the legal front from the White House. Here you were observing this extraordinary confrontation. What was going through your mind, Jack Goldsmith?
Well, again, let me just start off by saying I wouldn't exaggerate the extent to which they had heavy-handed responses. And most of the time, my rulings, even when they didn't like them, they abided by. And
I'm just going by the heat that you describe in the pages of your book when you would present resistance to what they wanted. I mean, this was a kind of a bellowing, table pounding. You can't do that. The president already has his vision.
That was usually David Addington's response. But in any event. Look, the hospital scene, I still to this day do not understand what they thought they would have accomplished by getting the incapacitated John Ashcroft to sign off. And it's a puzzle to me. I think that why they were there was because of the twin fears I talked about. They were afraid that tying the president's hands would get people killed, and they were also afraid of violating the law. If you think about it, it's quite extraordinary that the White House was going to visit the Attorney General in the hospital to get permission to do something that the president wanted to do. And this shows how important law was and compliance with the law was. I mean, they were there to try to get permission to do what they wanted to do.
But how real was their fear of eventual prosecution one day? Was that merely hypothetical, or did they really sweat it?
No, they really sweated it. Everybody did. And it was a very present fear.
Let's begin to go to our listeners. Linda's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Linda, you're on the air with Jack Goldsmith.
Hi, Tom. I just have a comment. When you have the president, the vice president, and everyone in the White House with executive privilege that cannot be questioned, that don't ever have to answer to anything, to me, that resembles a dictatorship. You have no checks and balances. You have no one accountable to anyone else except this one small group who's doing whatever they please. That's a dictatorship.
Linda, we'll take your observation. You share it with a conservative legal scholar who even so found it too much. But what do you say? This is a not uncommon complaint or fear these days, Jack.
Right.
What do you say?
I have to say I respectfully disagree with the caller. I mean, I was definitely there in the middle of some very heated battles and disputes over the law when there's no doubt that the White House wanted to do things that the Justice Department opposed. But I will say that ultimately they ended up abiding by all of the decisions when I was there. And there are every day, it's just not true that it's an administration that's exempt from checks and balances. They are, as I say, thousands of lawyers every day trying to ensure that they comply with the law.
If the transparency is not there, if there's a screen behind which things are going on, so they can't even be questioned, I guess Liz's point.
Sure. This is the danger. This is one of the dangers that one learns about when one works in the executive branch, because listen, we need the president and a powerful president to help us stay safe. That's absolutely certain, and that's why we created a powerful presidency in the Constitution. But there are dangers. The dangers are that the president controls the military and the intelligence apparatus. The president can act in secret, and the president, in a lot of contexts, gets to interpret the law that governs and limits what he does. And all of that is, as constitutional scholars have understood for hundreds of years, a recipe for potential abuse. So there's no doubt that there's a serious concern there. And there's no doubt that the White House was acting on the basis of legal opinions that I didn't agree with. But ultimately, I believe it's fair to say that the law, as the Justice Department understood it, prevailed.
Linda, thanks for your call. Let's go to Seth in Belmont, Massachusetts. Seth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have a question for Jack. I myself am an attorney, and I'm fully aware of the implications that all of, this administration's policies have on the Constitution and our constitutional freedoms and so forth. But my question for Jack is, and I would really, really love a straight answer on this, and it really calls to my attention yesterday when one of the senators asked Petraeus the same question. Is the policies that Bush has fought so hard to, make the policy of this country during these past, 7 years now, or 6 years since 9/11, have they made the country safer? Or, in your eyes, is there some ulterior motive here? Because if there is, I'm not exactly sure what it is, and I'd like to know what you think. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Seth, thank you. Jack Goldsmith? Straight answer.
I'll try to give a straight answer, but I'm afraid that my straight answer is going to be a bit of a dodge. I'll try to give you some answers. I certainly don't know whether, on balance, the administration's policies have kept us safer than some other array of policies might have kept us. There obviously have been some mistakes, some serious mistakes, as any administration would make. I do think that, and again, it wasn't my job to do counterterrorism policy and make those difficult decisions. It was my job to interpret the law. But I do think that a lot of the things that the president has done, a lot of the aggressive things, have, at least according to the people I talk to in the government and the intelligence community, done a lot to thwart the terrorists and keep us safe. If you think about it, a lot of people would have made a bet on September 12th, 2001, that 6 years later we would have had another attack. And it is extraordinary that we haven't. I do think the president gets a lot of credit for that. As for ulterior motives, I really do think that the people inside the administration, I criticize a lot of the things they did in my book, and because I believe that they made flawed arguments and they were sometimes embraced ideas that I didn't agree with. But I think it's a mistake to see them as pursuing executive power for executive power's sake or taking advantage of 9/11.
Though you do say that was on the agenda.
There's no doubt, but here's how it was on the agenda. The president and the vice president made very clear before 9/11 that one of their express agenda items was to expand the power of the presidency that they thought had been contracted too much in the prior 25 years, and to leave the presidency more powerful than they found it. And there's no doubt that that was an express agenda item, and we heard this all the time in the government. And there's no doubt that that attitude influenced how they went about and the means they used in pursuing the war on terrorism. And it certainly affected the choices they made, especially the choices they made about when and whether to go to Congress. So I certainly agree with all that, and I talk about that at great length in the book. But I don't think it's fair to say that they used 9/11 as an excuse to expand presidential power. I'm not sure if that's what the questioner meant. I just don't think that's the way the causal logic works.
But when you started throwing stuff in their way, well, your deputy Patrick Philbin said to you as you're in the car on the way to the White House, they're going to be really mad. They're not going to understand our decision. They've never been told no. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call from Jessica in Somerville, Massachusetts. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. This question is for Jack. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how other presidents have acted during wartime, if it's been a power grab for executive power. I'm wondering how this president stacks up in terms of what you call torturing the law in order to get more executive power.
This goes to a big point in the book, Jack, and I'm glad you raised it, Jessica. Thank you.
Yes, it's a very good question. I do talk about this a lot in the book. And there are similarities and differences. As a general matter, let me say, I talk a lot in the book about Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, two of our most successful presidents and certainly most successful wartime presidents, and two presidents who dramatically and in their time, unprecedentedly expanded executive power. And I draw on these presidents, these past experiences, to compare them with the Bush administration along many dimensions. First, both Lincoln and Roosevelt and Bush, all three, felt the imperative in time of crisis to do anything they could to save the nation. And they, all three of them, went right up to the edges of the law and sometimes exceeded the law. Lincoln famously did, Roosevelt more controversially. Second, I use the prior presidents to show how, in some circumstances, the president in this war is much more constrained by law than the prior presidents were, because they weren't acting in the face of criminal laws. They weren't worried about being prosecuted if they went too far.
Lucy is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lucy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a question for Mr. Goldsmith. It seems like you were willing to go to work for this administration. You agree with them in many respects, and yet now you're willing to speak out against them. And I'm wondering about your motives in an administration where it seems like many problems have come out of people being unwilling or unable to speak out against bad or even illegal policymaking. And so I'm wondering about your motives, perhaps even more personally, in speaking out, and maybe, you know, you could even call it pulling rank or whatever.
Your motives, Jack Goldsmith.
Yes, my motives in writing this book were to explain something I think has not been explained since 9/11, and that is the extraordinary pressures that the executive branch is under to keep us safe and to comply with the law, and the terrible tensions and contradictions that those twin pressures make, to explain how some of those pressures, in my opinion, led the administration astray in some of its legal policies. And hopefully to ensure, this was the main motivation of the book, to ensure that the mistakes that have been made in the last 5 or 6 years won't be repeated, and also to help people understand that there are genuine difficulties inside the executive branch that people are in good faith trying to deal with.
But you write, as a conservative, you write that President Bush's accomplishments may one day be viewed more charitably by future historians than they are today. But then you write, and I'm quoting you here, they will, likely always be dimmed by our knowledge of his administration's strange and unattractive views of presidential power. Could you articulate that view?
So this is when I'm comparing Bush to Roosevelt and Lincoln, and this is the Bush administration's general attitude of public attitude of having an agenda item to expand executive power, of along every margin trying to use executive power unilaterally instead of working with the other institutions of our government. And when you go back and look at, you know, Lincoln and Roosevelt made a lot of mistakes during their presidencies, and they committed what later historians viewed as civil rights abuses and errors. But on the whole, one of the reasons we look back on their presidency and their mistakes with regard to civil rights charitably is because we don't have this sense that they were expanding power for power's sake. We have this sense that they were doing things they thought was necessary to achieve, to protect the country. And I worry that the Bush administration's tactics and public rhetoric about executive power will cause it to always be viewed unfavorably.
So it's in a sense, in your view, the failure to go for consensus rather than just trying to roll over everybody that you see as, in sort of meta sense, wrong or the mistake.
Yes, I do. I mean, many of the policies, most of the policies, almost all of them, I agreed with. But my objections were to basically relying on precedents, old precedents, to basically go it alone in the face of Congress and the courts, and not to seek out and basically work with the other institutions of our government to put everything we were doing on a firmer and more legitimate legal basis.
You call it minimal deliberation, unilateral action, and then legalistic defense.
Right.
Kathy's calling from Williamsville, New York. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a question. You know, I'm personally also amazed that we have not had another terrorist attack. And I want every single thing to be looked at, to be done, to make sure we don't have another terrorist attack, because then our economy plunges and we're in a tailspin again. So I just wanted to get you right what I heard. So the administration goes to the Justice Department and says, we want to do A, B, and C. And the Justice Department comes back and says, we've looked at all the laws. You can't do that. When that happened, the administration then followed the law and didn't do what they had wanted to do. Is that correct?
Yes, it's correct. During my period there, they ultimately, after sometimes some fights, but they ultimately ended up...
Okay, well, to me, that is how government's supposed to work. That you know, that there are, that those are the checks and balances on the way our government was set up. And I'm listening to you, and I'm saying yes, that is the way. There should be challenges, and the law should prevail.
Though, Kathy, let me ask you just a question. Your perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, the Justice Department is pretty well staffed out by the White House, and until Jack Goldsmith showed up as he recounts it, as his deputy Patrick Philbin said, nobody had ever said no to them. I mean, so it's kind of happening in a black box, isn't it?
It was my understanding that when this president came in, he didn't go through and fire everybody like in previous administrations.
Well, I mean, there's always changeover, and his people hired Jack Goldsmith and a lot of others. But Jack, what do you say to this issue? He had not been told no, really, as you describe it, until you did.
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, I mean, I agree with the caller to the extent that, I mean, ultimately, you're supposed to have these fights in government. I actually think, if anything, there wasn't enough of these type of fights going on in the first couple of years. There was not enough. There's too much secrecy inside the executive branch and not enough of the type of deliberation you're describing. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the White House presenting objections to the Department of Justice's legal analysis and arguing and making arguments. I do think that in the first few years, I basically think that the legal advice in a lot of areas, in some areas, that they were getting from the Department of Justice was somewhat too permissive. And it is a danger. It is a danger when a presidency acts in secret, as he must in wartime. It is a danger when the president is self-interpreting the law. And, of course, there are other checks and balances that have worked to some degree, the press, the Congress, and elections, ultimately. But... the Department of Justice is there, among other things, to ensure that the president complies with the law.
But, of course, that's a closed circle, and if there's no one objecting or later writing, we don't know what happened inside that circle.
You might not. There's a lot of things that the public doesn't know that's happening inside the executive branch, and that's necessary to preserve national security, because we don't want our enemies to know about these things. But there's always a danger of excessive secrecy, and I certainly think that one of the errors that the Bush administration made was having too much secrecy, both within the executive branch, not enough internal deliberation, and too much secrecy vis-a-vis Congress, not enough collaboration and deliberation between the branches.
And we hear our caller's sympathy for the difficulty there. On the other hand, when there's secrecy and an administration has what you call a strange and unattractive view of presidential power, well, then we have to wonder what's going to go on. Jack Goldsmith, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome an old friend of yours, actually, into this conversation. Benjamin Wittes joins us from Washington. He's fellow and research director in public law in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. He wrote a column this week in the New Republic online titled, Jack Goldsmith's Critique of Bush is More Complicated Than You Think. Benjamin Wittes, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you have noted that Jack Goldsmith is being sort of lauded and hailed by opponents, critics of President Bush, as a hero for coming out with this book. But you say read carefully what this man's saying. What's the point you want to make there?
Yeah, well, let me be clear that I in no way dissent from the lionization of Jack Goldsmith.
You are old friends. We got it. Yeah. Yes.
No. It's more than that. I have nothing but admiration for his service in government, and I do, however, think that his book contains a challenge for the critics of the administration that is every bit as significant as the challenge to the defenders of the administration and to the administration itself.
Let's hear the challenge.
He actually alluded to earlier, which is, you know, that in terms of the substance of counterterrorism policy, if you read what he advocates or does not object to on the merits in the book, mm-hmm. it is actually a lot closer to what the administration did than it is to what the many critics of the administration who are, these days delighted by Jack Goldsmith mm-hmm. would have had the administration do. He does not object to the long-term detention without trial of large numbers of people under the rubric of war. He does not object to, the warrantless surveillance that the administration proposed to do and recently got a law enabling it to do. Mm-hmm. There's across the range of issues, there's a great deal in there that on the merits, on the substance, he actually agrees with the administration. And I think if you take that as a you take those sort of two critiques, on the one hand critiquing the executive power enthusiasms of the administration, but also insisting that the administration should be allowed to do the things that it was trying to do, that what he's really critiquing is the question of what the source of the power for that is. Is the source the inherent nature of the executive branch itself under the Constitution, or are these policy questions where, you know, a reasonable administration and a reasonable Congress would jointly come to the view that these are a lot of very difficult steps that need to be taken and for which political accountability needs to be diffused across the responsible decision makers in the government, in all three branches of government.
So if Jack Goldsmith is pretty much on board with what the Bush administration would do or would have done, what is it exactly that you think? We've heard from him, but how do you interpret what's provoked him to come out with a kind of tell-all book?
Well, I don't want to speak for Jack in terms of what's provoked him. I mean, I think the book actually, you know, sort of speaks for itself in the sense of what the concerns are. But I think Jack and I are largely in agreement about both the issues.
Ideologically, on the constitutional issues and counterterrorism issues?
I resist the term ideology, frankly.
Well, okay.
I think both in the sense that if you ask the question, what would an executive branch need to do in order to confront the terrorist threat, I think we would both argue that the powers that it needs are quite extensive. If the question then is, how do you go about getting those powers? That's a very different question, and I think the answer to that, at least speaking for myself, I have no trouble with the idea that if the administration goes to Congress and gives it a list of things and can really make an argument that it needs those things, Congress would be, and I think should be, fairly permissive in that regard. I do think it's really important that we have that set of conversations and not do these things as a creature of kind of inherent presidential powers in which other branches of government don't have their say, and as a consequence of not having their say, don't share in the responsibility for the outcomes.
Jack Goldsmith, Benjamin Wittes, your old pal, says critics of Bush don't take too much comfort in your critique. You're essentially on board. I mean, it raises an interesting issue. I kind of read you as saying, on the one hand, the administration may have tortured the law to find the permission that it wanted, but are you saying let's get these things out of the law. Let's remove this from the realm of law and into, I don't know, smoke-filled rooms or,
Well, two things to say about that. One is I think that both legally and politically the administration would have been a lot better off going to Congress earlier to get Congress and the country more generally on board for what it was, wanted to do, and it would have gotten a better reception in the courts. But there is a strand of my book that complains about and worries about the executive branch being strangled by criminal laws. And it worries about the constraints it puts on the president and the power it transfers from the politically accountable president to lawyers, basically, and lawyers who could be err on the side of being too permissive or not being permissive enough. And I do think it was that one of the major criticisms of the intelligence community right after 9/11 was lawyer-induced risk aversion. And there is a large danger of that, given the array of laws that restrict presidential power. So that is a large concern. It's easier to state the concern than to fix it, however.
Yeah, how do you pull these powers a little bit out of the realm of law, as you might do, without just sort of, you know, no holds barred.
Right. That's the danger, is that there are good reasons for these laws. They responded to abuses and concerns in the past. There are a variety of things that might happen. I think that we would be better to give the president more legal flexibility in what he's doing, but have a lot more searching sort of after-the-fact review of what he's been doing as a way of forcing the president to be responsible, something like the new FISA law does, although perhaps he could go further. At the end of the day, I think we're not going to get a pullback of these laws. We're probably going to get more and more of these laws. And at the end of the day, it's going to be a problem for the president, and it's going to put a lot of responsibility on the president to hire wise lawyers.
But that will happen in part, you write, because the Bush administration pushed the boundaries in the dark, in a way, with outside of consultation. If the presidents that you write so searchingly on here, Lincoln and FDR, could have whispered in the ear of George Bush or Dick Cheney along the way here, what's the kind of core advice that they might have given them facing these threats?
I think the core advice would have been, and I talk about this in the last chapter of the book, talk to more people, get more input, you'll avoid mistakes, and talk to Congress more, because you'll get better laws and you'll have better success in courts.
Ben Wittes, on the other side of this administration, a more empowered presidency or less?
Oh, I think much less. I think, and I'll give you just one example as I think it's a remarkable example that never gets talked about. The first administration to store large numbers of people at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in order to keep them away from the purview of the United States courts was the first Bush administration, which kept a bunch of Haitian refugees there.
H.W. Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. The second administration to do the same thing was the Clinton administration, who stored a large numbers of Haitian and Cuban refugees there. The third administration to do this is the current administration, who kept people of immeasurably greater dangerousness there. And this is the only administration that is going to pass on to its successor the inability to do that in the future.
And this,
so I think that's just a single example of the way that the failure to develop a consensus for something that, if you look at that policy, it really, you know, the fact that three successive administrations of two different parties did more or less the same thing suggests that it is an institutional need of the executive branch.
And here exactly the kind of point that Jack Goldsmith makes. Benjamin Wittes at the Brookings Institution, thanks for your piece in the New Republic, and thanks for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Goldsmith, author of The Terror Presidency, thanks for laying all this out for citizens to look at and consider. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.